Hello and welcome to another episode of Monday Mile, your walk and talk podcast, your source of moving motivation. I'm Amy Fuller and today's guest is an 11-time world champion, a 6-time Olympic champion, and he has transformed the sport of cycling in the UK. It is Sir Chris Hoy. Wicked, let's do it. So it's actually way slower than you would ever imagine.
The walk.
It's an amble.
Oh, I love it.
Jason Kenny style.
Jason Kenny speed. The slowest human being on earth when it comes to walking.
Yeah, not on the track, but no. Luckily we found a really nice loop here. So I'm hoping that you feel at home.
I do. I mean, Manchester, I guess from about 1999, was my home for 20 years. I live just half an hour away from here now, but I used to live sort of 5 minutes away. Came down to the velodrome opened in 94. So when I finished university, I went straight down here and it became my new home.
Nice. And of course we had to start today at a decent coffee shop. You love your coffee.
Well, I think most cyclists are kind of into their coffee. It kind of goes hand in hand. It's cafes are your meeting point before you go for your ride. You know, if you finish your ride, you might stop off, have a bit of cake, something like that. And it, you know, when you kind of get into it more seriously and you become, you know, cycling becomes your profession, you're not drinking alcohol, you're not going to pubs, so the cafe becomes your kind of social hub as well. So,
but maybe less cake?
Well, the coaches think that.
Yeah. When they're not looking.
Yeah, exactly.
So cyclists are notoriously known for coffee and their lack of desire to walk. But somehow today I have managed to entice you into a 1 mile long walk. Has your relationship with walking changed since retiring in 2013?
Absolutely. Do you know what? You feel liberated because you're absolutely right. When you're competing, you know, cyclists have the mantra, don't stand when you can sit, don't sit when you can lie down, because it's all about resting your legs for the next training session, the next effort. So, you know, you literally don't walk anywhere. We go to, you know, in the airports, we used to use little scooters to sort of get from point A to point B to try and minimise the amount of time on your feet. So, it's just one of these things that when you retire, you feel quite, yeah, I can walk places, I can do stuff, I can be a normal person now.
Love that. Well, we're going to have a nice little stroll today. Take us back to age 6 and watching ET and your journey into cycling.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't inspired into cycling from watching the Olympics or the Tour de France. I was inspired by ET, as you say. So I'd never seen a BMX bike before. It was the first time. And they were brand new in the UK. They just arrived. And I'd never seen a bike used that way before, you know, going over jumps and sort of carving through turns and just all the fun stuff you could do on two wheels. So I'd never even considered. So I thought, that's it. That's what I want to do. It wasn't so much, you know, having an alien in the basket in the front of the bike and flying off in the sky. I was, you know, that wasn't what got me. But yeah, that was it. That was the spark. And I guess no matter what it is you end up doing in life, there is that moment of inspiration. And it came thanks to Steven Spielberg.
And your first bike?
First bike.
Was it a BMX?
No. Well, it was made to look a little bit like one. My mum and dad got one from a jumble sale for £5. And they resprayed it black. And my dad put BMX stickers and changed the bars and the grips on it. And that was my first bike. It wasn't a BMX, it didn't last long, but it was, to me, it was amazing. And that was, yeah, that was your first bike's always the best bike, isn't it?
I vividly remember mine, actually. I think I
what
had,
was yours?
It was hot pink.
Oh,
little
nice.
Little Mermaid.
Uh-huh.
And my parents obviously were like, yes, you know, you need one with stabilisers. But I was adamant I did not want to use the stabilisers. So I think I probably had it a day and the stabilisers came straight off.
Good for you. Yeah, it's funny because stabilizers were a big thing back in the day, and now balance bikes are the, you know, the new thing. And that's, it's such a great way to teach kids how to learn to cycle, because really it's about having the control and the confidence, and you get that with having your feet down.
Yeah,
you know, and you don't need to have that stabilizer. When you take stabilizers away, you've got to almost relearn how to ride. So yeah, balance bikes have changed the way that kids approach cycling.
Yeah, it has changed, actually, when I think about it. I can't remember the last time I saw a kid on a bike with stabilizers. So how long did it take from age 6, you got your first bike, to start winning races?
Well, I started racing when I was about 7 at a local BMX track. And, but when I say racing, it was just on a Sunday morning, you turn up and sort of, you know, it was in age categories and it was just a bit of fun. But it was, I think I got second in my first race, and it was quite a while before I won my first race at Falkirk, maybe about a year later, or about 6 months later. And I always remember that feeling of getting this little tiny medal for first place and taking it back and showing it to my mum and dad, and just being so excited to show it to my mates.
So cool. You're known for your legendary thighs. You've had your legs compared to your wife's waist, Victoria Beckham's waist. But what does it take? What would an Olympic workout look like to sustain quads of that manner?
Well, do you know what? It's not cycling that makes your legs big. It's the weightlifting, the strength training. Yeah. For the sport. So, and we didn't train to get big legs, we trained to get strong and powerful, and your legs grew as a byproduct of that. So mainly through squatting. So you've got to be able to move your joints, or your muscles have got to go through a full range of movement. So a full depth squat with high load, you know, yeah, high weights. And yeah, just doing that on a regular basis, week in, week out, month in, month out, year after year, and they get bigger and bigger. And it's, you know, you look at a track sprint cyclist versus a Tour de France rider, you know, they're kind of your height, and, you know, these little...
and half the size.
They're basically, you'd be a good road cyclist, actually. These little whippets who, you know, it's all about power to weight.
Yeah.
And you know, even Mark Cavendish, a sprinter on the road, and you see him next to Geoffrey Hoogland or Harry Laveriston or one of the sort of track sprint lads, and he's about half the size. So it's all about... being, you know, your body being
sports
tailored specific for what you're doing, yeah.
And when you say a full depth squat, I think there's lots of opinions when it comes to a full depth squat. In your sport, what was the parallel with that?
Well, do you know what? It's you're not lifting for competition. You know, what you're doing is trying to train in a safe way to try and get stronger and more powerful for your sport. So a lot of it is down to your own physiology, your own biomechanics. So some people with their hips, you know, hips and joints and just their own bodies, they're almost unable to get into a safe full squat because of the length of the limbs. For me, quite long legs, quite long femur, it was quite hard to do it in a way that my knees didn't come too far forward and put stress in the front of my knees. So it's basically about going below parallel in a safe way, making sure you're not getting butt wink, you know, your back's not curving at the back, making sure that your knees are safe.
Do you still squat now?
I still squat now.
Can we get a little demo, little air chair?
A little demo? Well,
yeah, come on.
Here we go, side on or head on, what's the best way for... So if you're doing a squat now...
That's quite a narrow stance. Whoa, look at that!
There we go. There was a bit of butt wink there.
You've got very good ankle flexibility.
Well, I kind of have to, I think, because of the fact that if the knees go too far forward, then you do get the stress there. But yeah, it's about going to about that position there.
That is very impressive.
You think so?
Your range, your flexibility.
Well, I still squat because I quite enjoy it. It's one of these things that when you stop training full time, you realise that by doing lots of different parts of your the components of fitness, they all kind of
complement each other.
Well, yeah, and in some ways they do, but other ways they actually take away. So like the road riding and the sort of the longer efforts would take away from your strengths. The more endurance stuff you did, the weaker you got, and vice versa. So I was just doing very little cycle, or just riding for sort of fun, nice and gently, but I was pushing quite hard in the gym. And I recently got up to, or back in December, I got up to within 5 kilos of my all-time one rep max. So I did the 235 for a single, and 240 was my best ever. So it just shows you, if you do one thing and nothing else, and do it regularly, you can become much better at it than doing the lifting and the short efforts, the longer efforts, the road stuff, you know, it's like plate spinning. You've got to keep doing little bits of each to keep them all going.
And cycling now is so popular. You've been a huge part of that movement. We spoke briefly earlier about, you know, the secondhand bike market and, you know, the catalyst of cycling in the UK. Throwing it back to 2012, you're a huge part of that momentum. How does it feel looking back on the history of the sport in the UK?
Well, it's just incredible to see the transformation. Even it's quite poignant coming back to Manchester here, because, you know, when we first arrived in Manchester, Manchester was going through this whole growth phase. You know, there were parts of Manchester that huge investment were happening. They built the velodrome, Sports City, Man City's ground. All these kind of areas have been regenerated, and it's cycling has kind of almost gone hand in hand with that. And you see, you know, back then, to think that you go into, you know, you get into a cab, black cab.
Yeah.
In the old days, and someone, oh, you know, what is it you do? Oh, I'm a professional cyclist. All right, what are you, a courier then? No, I race on the velodrome. All right, what's that then? And you find yourself having to explain what you did. It's probably like yourself, you know, yeah. The Olympics have taken your sport to a whole new level, whereas 20, 30 years ago, people would be like, well, what is it? So, you know, now people do know about cycling. It's translated into participation. People are choosing to cycle to get around. They're choosing to cycle to get fitter and healthier. They're using cycling as a means to raise money for charity. You know, it is incredible. And to have played a really small part in kind of raising the profile, it is, I feel very proud.
You say a small part. That is very, very humble of you. But you've definitely played a major role in that. Cycling is now so popular, and arguably due to your success at 2012, how does that make you feel?
Well, it makes me really, really proud that we kind of, as a nation now, we do seem to really embrace cycling, and there's no doubt that the success in Beijing and London, the Tour de France success, but the success across the board, it's, you know, mountain biking, BMX, road, the whole thing, we've had people winning medals. And when someone from your country starts doing well, people follow it or take more of an interest in the sport. But it hasn't just stopped there. It's translated into participation. So people actually have been inspired, and it's not just a Wimbledon effect, you know, a couple of weeks of people getting their tennis rackets out and then they forget about it. It's people have sustained this interest in cycling, and it's not going to go away now. And it is genuinely amazing just to see the transformation that's happened. And the key thing now is to make cycling, to make Britain a more cycling friendly nation in terms of providing the infrastructure so that your average person that's not looking to try and win any medals or compete, but they just want to get around on two wheels, they want to choose cycling as a mode of transport to make it safer for them, to make it more appealing. And if you do that, then you're going to reduce the number of cars on the road, it'll make it easier for people that drive cars only to get around, but it'll make it safer and healthier and more fun for people that want to cycle.
And the now, Hoy Bikes, you're a big part of that process in supporting that two-wheel movement.
Well,
what's the plans?
Yeah, well, I guess a lot of the focus for us, the main focus is kids and getting kids on, you know, into cycling at a young age, encouraging them, making it easy as possible to ride and to learn, but most importantly to have fun, because I think if you enjoy something, you stick with it and you make it part of your life. So yeah, Hoy Bikes started back in 2013, so 8 years now. And I've just really enjoyed the process of actually helping to design the bikes and obviously promote them too, but to try and just create better bikes for kids to ride on and enjoy. And even more than that as well, we're looking beyond to potentially doing e-bikes and trying to make cycling as accessible and easy for people to get into as possible.
And that e-bike movement may be sometimes shunned upon by, you know, the road cyclists of the world. Tell us why e-biking kind of is the way forward for commuting.
Well, I think you're right that traditional competition cyclists might look at e-bikes and think, well, isn't that cheating? You know, you having a motor, surely the point of cycling is that you use your legs and your lungs and it's about exercise. But you still get that on an e-bike. You can still pedal a bike. You still have to pedal a bike. So you can choose how much of an effort you want to put in. You know, you could be going to a meeting or going to something that you don't want to turn up all hot and sweaty at.
Yeah, for example, in a leather jacket and jeans, hopping on a fixie or a single speed, cycling through London for half an hour, you're going to turn up looking like a drowned rat.
Exactly. But on the way home, you might actually think, well, do you know what? I want to have a bit of a proper workout here. So you can tailor it to whatever you want to do. And an e-bike, I think it gets people back on bikes who maybe haven't ridden for a while, haven't got the fit, or they don't think they've got the fitness to ride to work, or the commute could be a little bit too far, or there could be a massive hill on the way to work, or whatever that kind of stumbling block that puts you off riding. I think an e-bike can help you get over that. And it's really exciting, and it's interesting. You look at the trends in Europe, and it's starting to follow over here now, but e-bikes are actually outselling regular bikes now. So they reckon there'd be more e-bikes sold by 2030 than cars.
That's wild. And if it can help bring down the number of cars on the road and it makes cycling more accessible, then it's just a no-brainer, isn't it?
Well, it is. There's so many spin-offs to cycling in terms of reduced congestion, you know, improved health of the nation, reduced strain on the NHS, just physical and mental well-being that you get from getting regular exercise. So, you know, you don't have to plan your exercise into the day. You can just, your commute becomes your exercise. So for most people, just being active, being more mobile, that's the most important thing. It almost democratizes cycling. It gets everybody in. Doesn't matter what your level of fitness, doesn't matter what your experience is, just get on, get out, turn
that
your legs.
Mass participation. I wonder if we're going to see Boris on one of your e-bikes cycling into Westminster.
We'll see. I don't know if we let him, to be honest. But, I think it's cool because it does, joking apart, I think it brings people who are, you know, who might never have thought about cycling.
Yeah.
It just becomes a, you know, you go to Europe, you go into Holland or Denmark or Germany, people don't say, oh, I'm a cyclist. They get around on a bike. It's somebody on a bike. And there is that kind of tribalism almost that, I don't know where it's come from. It's the media pushing it, or it's just a general thing that seems to have happened over here, where you have to sort of categorize yourself as a driver or a cyclist or a taxi driver or a bus driver, whatever it is. We're all just people trying to get around, and we're all trying to do it safely. And I think if we look out for each other and make it a friendlier place, then you know,
friendlier environment.
Yeah, you know, it does work. You see it in other countries; it does work.
And let's not skirt around your phenomenal career. Four Olympics.
Four Olympics, yeah.
Six gold medals.
Yep.
11 world championship titles.
That's it.
And a silver.
You've done your homework.
And a silver Olympic medal. Is there a particular moment that stands out to you?
So many moments, and it's not just the moments that you might think about, the gold medal winning moments. They are special, but I think it's like anyone that's become an Olympian, anyone that's been to an Olympic Games, even just as a spectator, there's something special about the Olympics that's different to any other competition. And it's a privilege. It's a privilege to do it. And I think often you can take it for granted and focus on the performance and the outcome, but just getting to an Olympic Games, just getting that selection, and I think this last 18 months has really brought that into focus, where actually getting there is an achievement. You think what these athletes in the last year and a half have gone through, and they're there, or they're almost there now. Once you become an Olympian, it's something that you carry with you for the rest of your life. So in terms of one memory, I mean, if I had to pick one, the obvious one would be London, but I think actually Athens, becoming Olympic champion, stepping on the podium, and they read out your name, and then they say Olympic champion after it, and that's the first time you've ever been referred to that way. That's the
that
first
is
time.
That's wild.
And you go, but how's that happened? Because you never, like, I never thought growing up that I was an Olympic champion material. I thought that happened to other people. I thought that it was, they were born differently to the rest of us, and they were destined for greatness from day one. And they were just a different breed. And there I was, you know, this kid who just enjoyed riding his BMX and was never that good, but I just kept plugging away. And yeah, age 28, became Olympic champion. That was probably the most memorable moment.
Age 28, is that quite old or not for cycling?
Yeah.
Because I was 22 at my first games.
Yeah.
I didn't win an Olympic gold, but how old were you at your first games?
I was 24 in Sydney. And even then, it's like you look back now, most riders in sprint cycling will peak around sort of mid-20s, but they can be world standard or they can win the world championships or Olympics early 20s. So, but late 20s, early 30s, it's less common. And in London, I was 36, and that was,
that's crazy.
I was a proper veteran for that one.
Hanging on in there.
Yeah, exactly. And it felt like it though, because it's, I think when you get to that age, you can still do one-off efforts that are as good as you've ever done, but it's recovery, it's the fact you pick up injuries more easily, you don't bounce back from injuries as well, and it, I guess what outweighs that, or hopefully balances it out, is the experience you have and the knowledge of your own body and how to get the best out yourself, and the tactics and the racing, all these things come together to try and outweigh the potential decline in the physical side.
The age.
Yeah.
London 2012, you had the opportunity to carry the flag. You mentioned moments in your career. Would that be up there with one of the more unique experiences?
whenever I hear David Bowie's Heroes, the hairs on my arm stand up. It's unbelievable, honestly. It's like, it comes on, the opening few bars, and it's just like, wow, it brings me straight back. And it was such an emotional moment.
You had to walk, though. How about the opening ceremony? That's like,
wow.
You're standing in that galley. For people listening that don't know about the opening ceremony, traditionally in most opening ceremonies, you walk in, but then you've got, how long was it for London?
Well, if you work out from the moment you leave the village to getting back to your room, it's something like 6 hours. You know,
a day in the office.
Exactly. At least in the office, you're sitting on your bum. You know, it's insane because you have to, you know, you're just a lot of waiting. There's nowhere to sit. You're on your feet the whole time. And as we said already about cyclists not enjoying being on their feet, you know, wanting to rest their legs when they're not training or racing, it's you're really kind of out your comfort zone. And because you're not used to doing it, it makes it even worse. So, you know, I got asked, or it was about four or five days before the opening ceremony, I got this little phone call saying, you know, you've been picked by your teammates to carry the flag.
That's wild.
And we were in Newport, and I was like, well, we weren't due to come in to the village until after the opening ceremony, and this kind of throws the whole final few days, which was meticulously planned, out the window. And the team manager said, well, what do you want to do? I said, well, what do you think? I can't not carry the flag at the home Olympics. He said, right, we've got to try and find a way to get you there with the minimum amount of fuss. We've got to try and get you, you know, do the whole thing, minimizing the cost, the energy, energy expenditure, which sounds ridiculous. But if you're planning your final few days before competition, and it was only 2 or 3 days before I raced, you know, you wouldn't write 6 hours of standing in your program. That wouldn't be something you would choose to do. But I guess it's what you get back from it, the boost, the just that kind of energy that you get from that experience.
Did it give you a boost and a sense of excitement ahead of your competition, or did you feel elements of fatigue? Because I can imagine, you know, all eyes are on you, the team's behind you, the team's excited.
Do you know what? It was one of the most incredible experiences of my life. And I realised at the moment just how important it was for my whole London experience, because, yeah, people were saying, well, does it not add pressure? If you're the flag bearer, then is there not more focus on you to perform when you get to the Games? But at the moment I walked in, like when I went, you kind of give them the flag and then the announced GB, and you walk in, and then it's just this eruption.
Whoa!
It's unbelievable, honestly. And all these gold confetti cannons going off, and you're told about, okay, when you walk in, there's the royal box, you lift the flag up, down, you do this, and yeah, I remember that. You walk in, you forget a lot, and I was like giving it all that.
Yeah, I was going to say, flag, I'd go a bit wild with the flag, I reckon.
Oh, honestly.
they'd never give it to me. Unsafe pair of hands.
But at that moment, I thought, do you know what? The last 4 years, to get to this point, to make it to the Games, all the highs and lows, the hard work, it has been worth it for this moment. And it took the pressure off me. In a way, I thought, well, I've already got something from these Games before they've even started. This is enough. So anything that happens on top of this is
a bonus.
So I was able to relax and enjoy the racing in a way that I probably wouldn't have done if I hadn't done the opening ceremony.
And talking about pressure, obviously going into London as a medal contender, how did you actually deal with that load? What was the process to shift that weight off your shoulders?
I did a lot of work with Steve Peters, who was our team psychologist, and the main focus was working on perspective, you know, and it's something that has really helped in all my life, really. Steve really kind of started to sort of, you know, delve a bit deeper into, well, what is it that you're motivated by? What is it that's important to you? And you know, what do you think is going to happen if it doesn't work out? What's going to happen if you don't win? Is the world going to stop revolving? You know, is anyone going to die? You know, it's like, you start breaking it down, you go, actually, do you know what? You're riding a bike in anti-clockwise circles on a wooden velodrome. It's not life and death. And then when you can, you know, talked about like the helicopter technique, which was, you know, you said, well, imagine yourself in the stressful situation, the thing that's worrying you or causing you anxiety or stress. Imagine getting into a helicopter and just taking off and getting higher and higher and looking down on the situation. And the higher you go, the more you realise there's people and things all around you, and they've got things in their life going on, and how small you are and how irrelevant you are. And you think, do you know what? If you don't win this, you've still got 4 gold medals from the previous games. You've still been able to live your dream for all these years. you've got to see this as an opportunity to add the cherry on top of the icing, on top of the cake, and not see it as a burden, and go out there and express yourself, to enjoy yourself, live in that moment, because it'll be over before you know it, and if you don't enjoy it, you'll regret it.
That's such a nice way of looking at it, because I think more often than not, we as athletes, and so many athletes that I know, become totally consumed by the process and then the weight of the competition. But actually, the process of getting yourself to the end destination is your journey, which is, to me, the bit that you should be enjoying. Did you enjoy the grind in between the cycles, or how did you find that balance with enjoyment versus the graft?
Do you know what? I didn't enjoy in that moment when you're absolutely on the limit of what you can physically tolerate in terms of the pain. You know, in each section, you would wake up in the morning with your body aching, and you would be thinking, well, I've got a gym session, then a track session, then a road session. I've got this, and that's just one day. I've got this whole week ahead of me. And if you started looking at the bigger picture and thinking, well, how am I going to get through this? I'm absolutely shattered already. And it's only day one of a 10-day block or whatever you were doing. So I kind of tried to break it down into just tiny little chunks, just little stepping stones. So if I got the track, I wouldn't think about 12 efforts I was doing. I would think, I'm just get the warm-up done. And then once the warm-up was done, get the first effort out the way. Don't worry about the next 11 after that. Just do one at a time. And try to enjoy the process of taking little micro steps towards your end goal and enjoying just what you were doing. You know, you could get so het up on that kind of end result and the gold medal target, but the life passes you by and you miss the fun.
So quick.
And exactly. Once you know exactly what it's like, you retire and you look back and think, it passed like that. And it's one of the biggest bits of advice I would give to my younger self or to younger athletes is to of course care about the end result, of course give everything. And you got to fight for every position, and you got to fight for every medal or trophy or whatever. But enjoy the process. Enjoy what you do. Wake up in the morning and realise, actually, do you know what? Pretty lucky to be doing something that started out as a hobby, as a profession. And don't finish your career with any regrets.
Too right. So you retired in 2013. After that, you swiftly took to motorsports. I actually have dabbled in motorsports a little bit myself, yeah.
Cool.
And it was, for me, a catalyst into my career, actually, believe it or not.
Right.
So the other way around. So I did motocross from the age of
did
six.
You? I didn't know that.
So the elements of reading lines and transitions in a track helped me massively with my snowboarding career. But what was it that inspired you to take driving round, well, still going in a circular direction, but with a motor behind you? How did that all kick start?
Well, I think it was my legs were kind of past it, so I thought I need somebody else to push me along, give me a bit of a boost. I've always been a motorsport fan, and I never ever imagined that I would get the chance to do any kind of racing myself. But at the end of 2012, beginning of 2013, I did a documentary about Colin McRae, who was Scottish, world champion rally driver, one of my heroes, tragically died in 2007. And so we were doing this documentary for the BBC about his career. And it was through the filming of that Radical, who are a British sports car company, came to me and said, we've got this novice race series next year. If you fancy joining us, we can get your car and some tuition and get you through your test. And I'd done track days and, you know, I'd sort of things like that before, but I'd never...
You were doing that throughout your career, right? Sort of like post-season.
That's right. So at the end of each cycling season, I would go down to Alton Park in my Caterham, this little kind of tiny little lightweight, you know, road and track car, and just drive around all day having fun.
Class.
And do maybe 5 or 6 days a year, and that would be it. And I never, ever thought that would ever translate into actual chance to compete, but...
And you say compete very casually. You ended up racing against, you know, the top dogs, Mark Webber at Le Mans. What was it like lining up on the track?
Surreal.
With those guys.
Surreal. Very odd, because it's you're so acutely aware that you are a novice. So normally, if you're competing against big names in your sport, it's because you've worked hard for many years and you've kind of earned that right. But Le Mans, the 24-hour race, it's a pro-am competition. So most of the teams will have two pro drivers and one amateur driver in them. So you have to be of a certain level of amateur, but you know, you have to still qualify and go through the whole process. But you're still racing against guys who are, you know, have been Formula One drivers, who are some of the best drivers in the world, and it's on this iconic circuit in some really serious bits of kit. You know, the cars are, you know, some LMP1, LMP2 cars are only a couple of rungs off F1 in terms of the downforce and the pace they can go at. So it was just very surreal. And I remember the first time pulling into the out the pits and going down the Mulsanne straight, and it's something that I'd seen so many times on TV before, and just, you know, it was a childhood dream, really.
Is there any elements from cycling round in circles that you took onto the motorsports track that helped you? I suppose you're kind of under pressure lining up against yeah. those sort of guys.
There's so much pressure because, you know, you feel that it's not just about yourself. It's not just about you're aware of your own limitations and the fact, okay, you're not expecting to win. But it's more the thought of, well, if I do something wrong here, I could cause an accident. I could cause someone to crash. I could cause someone to mess up their race or get hurt or whatever. So there's so many thoughts. There's so many, you know, things that you feel are could happen and consequences of what you're doing. And if you don't apply the same sort of thinking as to when you were a cyclist and when you were competing in Olympic sport to the motorsport, then you could easily be distracted and make a mistake. Yeah. So the biggest crossover, the biggest thing I took from my cycling career into motorsport was the ability to focus and to block out the distractions and to not dwell on the things that could go wrong at any moment. So, you know, you're heading towards a corner, you know, in a fifth gear corner flat at 150 miles an hour.
That is wild.
And you start thinking, you're thinking, God, if I lift up a bit too much here, if I unsettle the car, there's a wall over there. If you let yourself be distracted and think about the consequences of what could happen,
yeah,
then it will happen. It's like, well, you know it. I mean, I'm sure, you know, it's the same with like downhill mountain biking or any sport that...
Oh, the fine line of consequence. I think if you let your brain go there, and I think this is where psychology is so fascinating, if you let your brain drift into that negative space, the what ifs and the fear, if you let it consume you, then you're not actually focused on the task, and mm-hmm. that's when it's more likely to go wrong.
Well, it draws you to what it's like a moth to the flame. You get drawn towards the negative thoughts, and then it's almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy. It will happen because you're letting yourself think about it. So if you can displace that negative thought, if you can push it out by focusing, well, what all I need to do here is focus on, you know, in the motorsport context, the braking point, the turning point, the apex, the throttle pickup. I'm not thinking about what happens if I get it wrong, because, well, if I do this in the right order, I won't get it wrong.
No, it's you process, know,
and
right?
So you focus on the process, not the outcome, and it sounds so simple, but it is simple. And the difference is that the guys who, like Mark Webber or, you know, whoever, the professionals who you're racing against, they've been doing it for so many years, they don't actively have to think the whole process through because it's second nature. But because it was a new thing to me, and I was in my mid-30s when I took it up, it's a bit like trying to learn a musical instrument in your mid-30s, and you get to play it once or twice a month, and that's it. You'd love to practice it every day, but you can't. You only get a few shots a month to do it, and trying to remember all these things, trying to make it feel like it's second nature, but it's incredibly difficult.
That's where ignorance is bliss. That's my motto. When you try something new, you just sail in there, and you're unaware of the consequences. But taking it to the now... Mm-hmm. Your routine, you've gone from full-time professional athlete to dad, entrepreneur. What's a day in the life of Chris Hoy looking like right now?
Right, well, right now, it's usually kids waking up about 6-ish, desperately trying to get an extra 10 minutes in bed before me and my wife get dragged out of bed, and then it's just the process of getting their breakfast, getting them dressed, getting the bags packed, Chloe off to nursery, Calum to school, teeth brushed, what books do you need, what have you got, mini sports today, have you got this, it's like chaos in the morning, and then you get them out the door, drop them off at school, and then it's like, right, okay, what's, you know, you check your phone, check your calendar, what's on the plan today, and every day is different, really. I mean, this last year obviously has been a strange one, but there's sort of a few things that I'm doing at the moment. We've got the bike range, Hoy Bikes, that's a lot of work that goes into that. It could be something like this, doing an interview, a podcast. It could be, I do a fair bit of, virtual events at the moment, but, you know, in the real world as well. Speaking events where you get to go and talk to a group of people and discuss something that's relevant to them, or, you know, reflect on your own career or whatever. Ambassador roles with companies. charities that you work with. It could be working with you know, children in terms of encouraging them to get into sport or cycling or whatever. And it's just a, every week is different. So you go from living a life, and I'm sure it was the same for you, very predictable, very kind of ordered, very structured life that you could, you know, almost every day was the same routine, to being not chaotic, because you like the
No, but you're like, you're almost like thrust out into the wild and it's kind of on you to create and generate your own future. And you're clearly passionate about cycling still, which is freaking epic, inspiring people to get out on two wheels. Do you still cycle now, and what's your relationship like with fitness? Is it a big part of your life?
Yeah, I definitely cycle. I wouldn't say regularly, because I don't get out as often as I'd like. But what I do is actually do an indoor cycling session. So, you know, to go out for a ride on the bike, ideally, you go out for a couple of hours if you've got the time. But trying to fit 2 hours into a busy day when you've got work commitments, you've got kids, you've got all sorts of other things going on, it's not easy. So I find the indoor stuff is actually
a bit more accessible.
Much more accessible. Even half an hour, you can do a really good session in half an hour, 45 minutes. So I do a fair bit of the indoor stuff. I've got a little squat rack in my garage at home.
Keeping that range still on check.
Keeping that range.
We checked that earlier.
And I do stuff like, I'm an ambassador with Pure Gym, so wherever I'm in the country, I can get access to a gym that I can use. So it's, I think it is important. I think when exercise and sport has been part of your life for so long, if you suddenly stop, I think it's only then you realise actually you need it. You need it for not just your physical health, but your mental health as well. I think I get super grumpy if I've not been out on the bike or been in the gym for a couple of days. I get lethargic, I lose energy, get grumpy.
I get so aggy. Oh. I think sort of post-career, I've just discovered how important movement is, and I think it's about scaling it and making it more accessible.
Yeah.
Like you said, whether it's doing it on an indoor bike or doing something rather than nothing. So, for example, this morning, it was like, okay, right, you know, I'm in Manchester, I've got half an hour before I meet Chris, and it's like, what can I do that's actually just going to make my body and my mind feel good? Mm-hmm. I think it's so important.
Yeah.
Talking about mind, coffee, is it true that you took a coffee machine to the Olympics?
Of course. Why wouldn't you?
I'm sorry about that.
It's not just the coffee machine, it's the grinder, it's all the bits of kit. It's like, because the trouble was, most coffee, you know, you get, and it's going to be fairly average quality. And once you've got into it, once you've become a complete coffee obsessive like I am, then I'd almost rather not drink coffee than drink bad coffee.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's not that I needed a coffee for competition, or it wasn't I had to have it.
It's enjoyment, right?
Exactly. It's something to look forward to in your day. And so, yeah, I had my machine, my grinder, all the fresh beans and everything with me. So if you're traveling somewhere in Europe, you just put it on the van with all the bikes. If you're traveling abroad, if you're flying there, it's a bit trickier. But yeah,
that is absolutely brilliant.
Well, we had, you know, all of a sudden you become really popular, and all your teammates, you're like, oh, hi guys, they're knocking your door in the hotel. I just thought I'd come around and see how you're doing. Oh, yeah. Oh, you've got the machine on. Oh, can I have a little coffee? Oh, yeah, of course. But
that is brilliant.
It's funny because a lot of us, I really got into coffee in Australia. So we go to Perth every year for maybe 5, 6, 7, 8 weeks sometimes at a time. And that was when I first started drinking coffee in the cafes and realizing actually this is a lot better than some of the rubbish you get, you know, some of the chain brands, you know, the ones you get in the high street.
And you're into your cooking as well. I've seen, is it the odd beef brisket and...
Oh, yeah, brisket.
Pork.
Pulled pork, brisket, beef short ribs, pork belly, all that kind of stuff. Yeah, barbecuing, low and slow.
Big part of the Hoy family household.
Barbecuing, coffee, lifting weights, riding bikes.
That sounds like a nice balance
to me. Fills your time, bit of red wine.
Love that. So on Monday Mile, we have to ask every guest what their relationship is like with the start of the week. We've spoken briefly about the life of Chris Hoy now. Has your relationship with Monday changed since retiring, becoming a dad, being that chef?
Chef. Mondays used to be, well, they would be your first day back training after your rest day. Sundays were the rest day. You just go out for a gentle hour on the bike, and that would be your recovery day. And then Mondays were back in the gym, back on the track, hitting it hard.
Back
on the grind. And I never used to sort of get up on a Monday and think, oh God, it's Monday. I used to quite look forward to it. And now, do you know what? The days kind of all get merged into one. And, you know, especially during the pandemic where it's just, you know, when the kids weren't at school or at nursery and they were at home all the time, it was just like this every day, just sort of, you know, melted into the next. But now, yeah, Mondays mean kids back to school, Chloe at nursery, that's great. We can get a bit of peace at home, crack on with the things needing done. But yeah, I've never been...
Almost a rest day then.
Well, honestly, yeah.
Are back at school.
Well, you think life's tough as an athlete. You think, oh, you know, I've got to work hard and be disciplined in my diet and, you know, all these things that you can't get to go and do. It's nothing like being a parent. A parent is the toughest job in the world. It's like equally rewarding, but it is, yeah, you lack of sleep. Being an athlete, you know, you get to sleep all the time. Whenever you want a nap, you can have a nap. Whenever, you know, you can have 10 hours, 11 hours a night, no problem at all. You have kids and it's just, you suddenly realise that sleep is the most valuable thing in the world. It's, oh, yeah, one day I'll get a nap in the afternoon.
And lastly, Chris, do you have any little nuggets or life mottos that you live by that you can share with our listeners to give them that source of Monday motivation on the day where they're thinking, oh, I don't know if I can do this?
Nuggets of motivation. I think just get through the moment. Don't think too far ahead. You know, if you start looking at the magnitude of the challenge or what, you know, your whole week ahead, then you can think, oh, I've got so much to do. And you almost get sort of overcome by the challenge. Just you have to do all that right now. Just pick the one thing. What are we going to do right now? Get through that moment and then the next thing and then the next thing. Just live in the moment. You know, do the best you can right now. And then, you know, it leads you towards your end
goal.
It's
a catalyst, isn't it? It's a focus on the now.
Once you get momentum, it's easy. It's just getting started. And also when, I guess, reminding yourself, from motivation's perspective, reminding yourself what it is that you want the most. So, you know, there can be times where you think, oh, it'd be easier to do this or shortcut, or you're, you know, trying to follow a specific diet or whatever that you're trying to be strict on. Remind yourself why you're doing it, what it is that you want to do, you know, whether it's even exercise, if you want to be more active. Just get out, get started, and you'll be glad you did it afterwards.
Yes, love that. Monday Mile, Chris Hoy, thank you so much for joining us for a lovely little stroll.
Boom.
In your ends, for coming to visit me for a little coffee, and so grateful that you now like walking.
I love it, it's my new hobby. Thank you.
What a gentleman. So Chris Hoy, an inspiration and some really solid words of wisdom. I want to say a massive thank you to Chris for joining me for a little stroll around Manchester. If you've not left that episode feeling inspired, then what will? The main takeaways for me were perspective and living for the now. I have to say, I am so glad to be back out walking and talking. Monday Mile listeners, you know what to do. Make sure to subscribe, leave some feedback, and if you want to see the visual highlights from our walk, you can see them on my Instagram at Amy_Fuller. Please do leave us a little comment and a rating in the audio app you are listening to us on. And you know what? We will see you next week. Happy strolling.